Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now, welcome along. So, with the change schedule this afternoon, we're going to squeeze in the Sunday Papers as best we can. It might be slightly shorter than usual, but we'll squeeze it in as best we can between kick-off in the Premier League at 4:30. We're joined in studio by Philip Quinn, who you'll read in the Irish Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday. And we have Bernard Jackman as well, Heineken Cup winner with Leinster, Irish international, a coach at Grenoble and the Dragons. And now, Bernard, I was just saying there, a tie-wearing, suit-wearing schmuck like the rest of us.
And I'm enjoying it.
Welcome to reality.
Exactly, yeah. No, it's been good. It's been a good transition. And, totally imposter syndrome. I'm suffering from that every day, but it's getting less and less. And, yeah, I'm enjoying the real world.
I think so. There's the voice in your head who says you're just here because you're Bernard Jackman rugby player. You have to shoot that guy down a little bit.
No, absolutely no. Coaching is a very fickle career. Obviously, you know, I know that better than most people. And that's where my family are at, my kids, my wife. I just need some stability, and you know, getting on a plane and commuting from France or Wales or the UK wasn't what we needed to do at this time. And it's good to prove I can do something else as well. I never started off to be a professional rugby player, it just kind of happened. Coaching I am massively passionate about, and I'm still getting to fulfil that passion through working with Bechtev and obviously working in the media. But yeah, I need to prove that I can do something outside of sport, and I'm getting to do that at the moment.
Well, I've no doubt you will. I heard you speaking on, it was a rugby podcast, I think a UK one maybe about a year ago or some stage in the last 18 months, and you were making the point in that interview that you're at an age now where you felt you could give rugby coaching another bash. Maybe you go in as a head coach again, or maybe you go in as part of a team.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't work out, you could find yourself in 5, 6, 7 years and you might be at an age where it would be really difficult to get into the real world. That was your thinking.
Yeah, and I've spoken to some coaches who are suffering a little bit and are on the outside. And at 43, I was lucky I came back to Dublin. There's a lot of companies willing to give me a chance and see me as being not young enough to transition. Whereas maybe at 53, that wouldn't be the case. And you know, that's the reality of it. And still have enough time to hopefully be successful in other areas or come back to coaching if that's what I want.
I've no doubt.
Just good to be involved in something that I'm enjoying and getting to hopefully prove myself in a different industry.
I asked this as a journalist, Philip, you'll understand. Did you struggle with the insecurity that was held in the future?
No, I didn't really, but I could sense that it wasn't great for my family. You know, I would always back myself to make a living, but what you want to be in a career where your family aren't worried about whether you win on Saturday. Mm. You know, as much as, obviously it affects me as well, but that's the issue, is just having that stability for your close ones, more so than myself.
Mm. I'm sure you'll be very successful, whatever you choose to do. Okay. I'll start with headlines then. And as you can imagine, and Philip, you were at the press conference on Friday. Front page of the Sunday Independent news section, FAI crisis, Varadkar now ready to step in. So the Taoiseach quoted, courtesy of the Sunday Independent, speaking to the paper last night, will definitely try to ensure that grassroots schoolboys and women's football doesn't suffer. This has gone right to the very top of Irish life, this situation. We have the Sunday Times again, main section, obviously. So much of what's happened this year started in the Sunday Times on their front pages. CAB and tax experts study FAI accounts. This is John Mooney and Mark Tai. So it seems that the Criminal Assets Bureau is being assembled by Garda headquarters to investigate the financial affairs of the FAI. And interestingly, they say the inquiry will examine whether the expenses paid by the FAI to its former chief executive, John Delaney, should have been declared as taxable income. That is one of the things they are looking into. Sunday World, this was dreadful last night. The Manchester Derby. Bottlers, and the picture is of items being thrown at Manchester United player Fred. City embarrassed at home as fans throw missiles at victorious United. Beneath that, by the way, Sexton, Six Nations worry after injury. He went off with a knee injury, was being iced on the side of the field yesterday against Northampton. A scan will tell us more, but it looked serious-ish, you would have to say, concerning. Back page of the Mirror, again, it's Manchester City 1, Manchester United 2. Hit and miss, again, a picture of Fred here. What a disgrace, they say. Fred, after being hit by an object, and above, the fan alleged to have been involved in racial abuse. And they have a small picture here. It's pixelated, so I'll hold it up to the camera. But the fan, who was caught on camera, making a monkey gesture to Manchester United players. Mail on Sunday, then. Manchester United again, a race storm. United's derby win is overshadowed by shameful abuse. That's Chris Wheeler here. And again, a pixelated picture. Angry City set to investigate racism. And you can see pretty clearly here. The gesture is unmistakable, and it was discussed to their credit on Sky Sports afterwards. Gary Neville was even referencing Boris Johnson's performance in the leaders' debate the night before as fueling what's been a grim 3 years over on that side of the pond. Meanwhile, Sunday Independent, dogged Munster survive both the dismissal to hold on for victory. This was Munster beating Saracens by 10 points to 3. And beneath that, Shane Phelan says, hopes of resolution fade in Mayo funding row. And then finally, Sunday Times Sport, picture here in the top right. We'll get to Anthony Joshua if we can. Various reports on his performance last night. They have Christmas Comes Early and a picture of Marcus Rashford. United follow-up win over Jose by beating neighbours and leaving City 14 points off the top. And then the reports on the rugby yesterday, Ireland enjoy English triple crown. Darcy in the running for top Dublin job as well. So Declan Darcy, says Michael Foley, who has a great interview inside with Ono Garra, which we'll hopefully touch on. Declan Darcy has emerged this weekend as a strong contender alongside Desi Farrell to succeed Jim Gavin. And he mentions, as I'm sure you might have seen, Pat Gilroy confirmed last week his unavailability due to work commitments. And then here again, probe into racial abuse of players. Manchester City working with police after allegations of racial gestures being directed towards Manchester United players were made last night. They talk about the 68th minute when Fred was heading over to take a corner, and then they also reference one supporter could be seen on Sky Sports coverage making what appeared to be a monkey chant and gesture in the direction of Jesse Lingard, who was close by. The closest City player was Raheem Sterling, who's been an outspoken critic of racism in the English game. Later on, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said, I've seen it on video. It was Jesse and Fred, and the fella must be ashamed of himself. Unacceptable. And he said that the racist abuse perpetrator should be banned for life. Simple as that, said Solskjaer. I'm sure you've been over to Manchester numerous times, both of you, in your sporting careers. It is a multinational city. It is a very liberal city. It's a great city in so many ways. And yet you have idiots like this. It was quite shocking, really, when you first saw it on camera, captured so clearly and so perfectly, because stadiums are so well lit now. Yeah. You see this guy. And in a weird way, because he was wearing a gilet,
stood out.
The red arms against the black jacket stood out, and he was doing it in the most subtle way, but the most disgusting way, and you just wanted to throttle him, and you just think, Raheem Sterling is standing right there, your own player, and this is the carry-on.
The only positive is he's been caught, and it's so clear-cut. I saw his company, he's been named online, his company have come out and said they know the allegations there, the company he works for, and they're going to investigate it. So, again, it's absolutely disgraceful. It's happened, but you know, the only thing that we can do is make sure that any time it happens, that the action is swift and hard. And hopefully, it's going to take a long time. It looks like it's going to take a long time to get it out. But the more when we catch someone red-handed at that, the scrutiny is on him, and you know the punishment is very severe. And in fairness, I heard Solskjaer talking about it and just said it's coming up all the time, and you just can't understand how, you know, it continues to happen. But listen, we have to make sure that it's not tolerated, and at least he's been caught.
Absolutely, and Jamie Redknapp made the correct point. It's a societal issue, and Gary Neville picked up on that and said, "Yeah." And I watched the leaders' debate, and I watched what Boris Johnson had to say, and I didn't like it, and I haven't liked the last 3 years. And then Roy Keane, as he so often does, can get to the nub of a situation, and he simply said, there are always a few idiots everywhere, and there always probably will be. So that's why it's difficult for football to totally get rid of it.
It is. I watched it as it happened, and you know, I'm a Man City fan for 50 years, and leaving aside the football side of it, and the better team won yesterday, make no mistake. Mm. It was pretty awful to see what happened, and when you see the Manchester United player as well, Fred, he's been hit in the back of the head by something. So you have the racist abuse, you have the violent act towards opposition players, and Manchester City fans have a very good reputation over the years, but it only takes a couple, as Roy Keane says, it only takes a couple of idiots. Whatever the crowd was, over 50,000 people there, so you could have 49,000 people were fine, and one or two fellas, one or two people let the club down and let themselves down, and it was shocking. And I'm delighted to hear that action has been taken, that City are cooperating, and that the person who made that gesture should be banned from football for life. Mm. And the person who threw the object, I think actually was a suggestion, might have been a lighter, a cigarette lighter, which could have caught somebody in the eye. Mm. They should be barred from football for life. It took the glass off, actually, what was an outstanding performance by Manchester United yesterday. Solskjaer got his tactics spot on. Mm. He realised City were slow at the back, and he backed his defence to sort of muzzle City, and then he countered quickly at pace. James, Rashford, Martial, City's ageing, creaking defence had no reply. Mm-hmm. But it did gloss over what was it shouldn't take away from what was a very, very disturbing and difficult moment for football. Yeah. And you know what? You know what, Joe? A couple of days ago, remember the headline in the Italian paper, yeah. Black Friday, above the Lukaku and Smalling were playing against one another. You know, and this is a newspaper. You're supposed to be leading by example, and they're putting this on a headline. And again, that was completely
and they've stood over.
Wrong.
They've stood over and tried to argue that they're celebrating difference and it was a good thing. So that's where we are on that front. I don't think the players thought it was great. There's lots for us to get through in the time we have. So there's more Joe Schmidt World Cup talk because of the Rory Best comments, and there are a few comments during the week. There's a great interview with Ono Gara, you mentioned as well, Philip, there. Michael Darmacauley's been interviewed. Johnny Evans is in the Sunday Times. There's Joshua Ruiz. There's a Paul Kimmage piece I think that it's important we reference as well and touch on. But we have to start with the FAI, which is on the front pages everywhere, main sections. So the Sunday Times front page, just to expand on what I mentioned there, that the Criminal Assets Bureau assembled by Garda headquarters to investigate the financial affairs of the FAI. They want to see whether or not the expenses paid by the FAI to former Chief Executive John Delaney should have been declared as taxable income. They will also seek to establish whether the association met its obligations under the Companies Act. Go on to say that it also emerged that the FAI paid Delaney previously unreported personal expenses of $295,000 in 2016, $74,000 in 2017, and $206,000 last year, including payments for Delaney's 50th birthday, hotel bills, and credit card expenditure, including cash withdrawals. And they did make the point, though, that the FAI's payment of $69,000 for Delaney's 50th birthday in 2017 was being counted now as part of Delaney's remuneration. That the former chief executive is understood to have repaid $50,000 to the FAI for the event. There was, and I know you were at the press conference,
yep.
Philip. Important point to make here, and it's touched on very well in the Mail, actually. It might be the best place to mention it. But Dick Shakespeare was there.
Yeah.
And he's a Dublin City Council
senior
official.
Figure.
Yeah, senior figure. And he spoke, and just his comments jumped out at me. So Shakespeare hears Enron echoes in FAI shenanigans. And this is the piece you wrote, Philip. And he's talking here about the FAI received $6.5 million from Mike Ashley's Sports Direct as a payment to become the new FAI kit sponsors. Only the deal should never have gone through, as the FAI were already tied to a legally binding contract with another company who cried foul. So now the FAI have to pay back $100,000 a month to Sports Direct. And here's the incredible thing. Shakespeare felt the arrangement revived echoes of the Enron scandal of 2001. He said, in terms of the Sports Direct thing, that is the big swing. The big swing being in terms of the amount of money that they thought they owed and now they do owe. That would potentially be an Enron type of exercise. That would probably be the most disappointing piece on that one. Basically, you were booking an income stream in 1 year that you were selling, but you were selling your future. If the FAI are 6.5 million in, then you have got to unwind that. It is an effective doubling of the debt in the accounts. Enron was on a far greater scale, but that is what it reminded me of when I first heard about it. I thought that was a bit Enronish.
Yeah,
Enron is a byword for the biggest scandal or close to it in financial history, and we're seeing something Enronish crop up in Shakespeare's opinion at the FAI. Mm. The general mood on Friday, was it a bit surreal? Was it downbeat? People may not have seen it, they've only read about it.
The general mood was one of sort of shock and awe what we were hearing, because the FAI have never sort of laid bare their financial affairs of that before. They basically put it on the slab and said, look, here, pick away at the corpse. The Enron connection, which came up afterwards when Dick Shakespeare spoke to a few journalists, and he's a bright guy, and he's got a good job in the Dublin City Council. He knows what he's talking about, and he knows he would have learned, as he said, he learned all about integrity from the late great Tony O'Neill. Who's sorely missed and was the greatest administrator the FAI have ever had. Actually, from the moment he left the FAI in 1990, and I touch upon this in the piece in the Mail, that there's been a series of crises. We've stumbled from crisis to crisis. But the Enron deal was they basically hid billions of dollars from failed projects and debts, and they just kept them away from the public, and then it was exposed and the whole thing collapsed. And they actually brought down a very big accounting firm as well, who were sort of came on board and went along with it, and then they were exposed. And I don't know what's more is to come. I think my fear is that, you know, we haven't got to the bottom of this. And when you see the Sunday Times mentioning the cab were involved, I mean, that report from Cozy Accountants went straight to the Garda headquarters in Harcourt Street, is where their fraud squad are based.
Yes, and we can't speculate,
but you can certainly speculate, Joe, that there's more to come. You expect that there's more to come.
Yeah.
What was the mood like? The mood, it was a very warm room on Friday. It was too warm. We actually later in the day, I was there for 2.5 hours, and we opened up the windows and we opened up the side doors and just a little bit of air in. And Donald Conway came in, and it was supposed to start at 12, then we put back to 1. And then Paul Cook and the board members came in at about 22 minutes past 1, and they sat down. And there was another 7 minutes while the central chair was empty, and you're kind of waiting for the president to come in. And he comes in, and Donald is a very composed, sort of articulate, sort of calm man. And I got the impression he was a little bit flustered, because he came in and he said, "Good morning, everyone." It was 1:29. And I kind of thought he's in a little bit of a haze, because he kind of knows what's coming. I'll give the FIA a certain amount of credit. They did say, "Look, guys, these are the figures."
Yes.
And they put panels up, and you're able to sort of go through it, and you're going millions here, millions there. There's so much been talked about, but on the Sunday papers, to get back to it, you mentioned there the Sunday Times on the front page, and I was just in the sums there, you know, about the John Delaney's previously unreported personal expenses for 3 years, and they come to €575,000 personal expenses. And on top of this, there was a deal that he signed in 2014 for around €3 million.
I mean, loyalty bonus.
This is an association that's broke, and they're basically guaranteeing their chief executive on top of his salary and on top of his allowance. I'm kind of wondering, you know, did anybody ever think to stop and cry, "Hang on, guys, blow the whistle. Match is over here. Can we just take a long, hard look at where we're going?" We can jump around quite a lot, Joe, but your initial question was about the mood.
Yeah.
The mood was somber.
Yeah.
There was honesty, and there was an admission of wrongdoing. But unfortunately, I thought it was the time for Donald to do it. He didn't do it.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about
that. He didn't offer an apology.
A few papers, various journalists make that point, that Donald Conway was offered the chance to just apologise, and he decided not to. How much pressure was he put under to apologise?
No,
do you remember that
I'd asked him back in October, and he said he'd declined to. And he said he didn't believe in apologies.
Yeah,
and he spoke about... the quote is actually, if I have it here.
You have it in your piece, do you?
Yeah, he said...
It's not that I'm against apologies.
Yeah, but the apology thing doesn't weigh with me. He says, "I don't think it's a particularly meaningful act." And I said, my own words, it is meaningful, and it wouldn't have cost Conway much to apologise on Friday. Certainly not for £62.3 million. And by the way, that latter figure is what their liabilities are at the moment. Mm. And I kind of thought, you know, just say sorry. Just say, "I took my eye off the ball and I should have been more diligent and I'm sorry." It doesn't take much to say that, but he declined to go down that road.
Well, I think he should have. He might argue he didn't take his eye off the ball, but the figures are pretty damning, that's for sure.
He said he wasn't given the right information, but he should have asked the questions.
I was shocked, to be honest. The FAI's financial shame laid bare. That's page 3 of the Business Post. Roisin Burke here again, like a lot of journalists going through the various figures, which are eye-watering. Do you feel, Conway was later asked by RTE, "You have served Irish football well." "I do," he said, detailing his Trojan work on the underage game and on emerging talent. Did you? It says, well, RTE did as well, and player development programmes. Is this rock bottom, someone asked.
Yeah, and Cook said yes.
We think so. We're at the beginning of a new dawn for football, Shakespeare said.
There's a lot of stuff in a lot of papers. And another one, you're in the Sunday Business Post, and Paul Cook was involved in the paper before. The Sunday World have on the front page a Brian Kerr strap line, which talks about the money being soul destroying for Irish football, and money being frittered away in a devious way. That's Brian Kerr's quote.
Yeah.
The Sunday Business Post, I think, on the front ear on the top left hand side, FAI in survival battle on Delaney's legacy of excess. As Delaney's legacy of excess is exposed. Inside the Sunday Indo, then you have a full page of comment. Eamon Sweeney, John Green and John Fallon. Eamon Sweeney talks about the Vantage Club being the sort of the noose that basically, you know, was wrapped around Ireland's football's neck. And it was Delaney who drove that plan. And he said it was clear that when that collapsed, because the prices were ridiculously high, and you must remember the FAI were given a chance. They were offered by a third party, said, "We'll give you the money for all the seats and we'll go and sell the 10-year tickets and there's no risk for you." And they said, "No, we'll sell the seats and we'll keep the profits." And when that collapsed, Sweeney makes the point that it was clear that the wrong man was in charge, and yet Delaney stayed in charge for another 11 years.
Because it's interesting, John Green comes at it from a different angle, and it's an interesting read as well, where he talks about the efforts really to try and find out what was going on down the years. And he talks about a piece Tommy Conlon even wrote 12 months ago. And Tommy made the very fair point in his piece 12 months ago. In 06, the GAA's turnover was 30 million. By 2017, 65 million. 07, the IRFU's turnover was 48 million. By 2017, 85 million. FAI in 2007, 45 million. 2017, 49 million. In other words, Tommy wrote, the IRFU and GAA have raced ahead of the FAI in terms of financial performance over the last decade, and yet the CEO of the worst performing organisation is paying himself by far the most money. And this drew massive annoyance from Delaney, says John Green. He phoned, he demanded apology, said his family had been upset with the contents. In a rare insight, writes John, to his more ruthless side, he questioned Tommy's fitness for the job as a columnist, saying his piece lacked humanity, empathy and accuracy. The Sunday Independent stood over the piece, the decision to publish it. Those words, writes John, humanity, empathy and accuracy ring very hollow this weekend. He does reference you, Philip, along with Dion, Paul Rowan, Paul Lennon and others who chipped away for years and tried to get answers and weren't so sure what was going on. Would I be right in saying, and correct me if I'm wrong because it's a bit before my time, that when John Delaney first came on the scene, you would have had high hopes for him and you would have thought this guy has the potential to be the great reformer?
Yeah.
And if that was the case, how quickly did you start to think this ain't quite what I was hoping for?
I think John had a conversion at some point along his journey. I don't know when, but I would have met him first of all back in the early 90s, before, when his father was treasurer. And we came quite close as he rose up the ranks of the FAI. I was there the night he became treasurer, the youngest treasurer of the association. We were down in Cork. We drank away the evening that night, and we were good pals. And then the Saipan, he emerged from that he sees his opportunity after Saipan. And for the first couple of years, he was excellent, Joe. He really was, because the FAI did need new leadership. It did need somebody who was young and dynamic and had ideas. And John had all those things. And he was a personable guy. And he was good with the media. And he did sort of bring a sense of order and control to an organisation that had an image of sort of, you know, cloth cap and bicycle clips, you know, and Merrion Square at the railings there. Mm-hmm. And he oversaw the move to Aberystwyth, which was a good move. And funny enough, that was the anniversary of that was this week as well. I remember thinking, Jakers, Platini opened that in Aberystwyth, I think it was 2007. Mm. Here we are 12 years back on the exact anniversary, and things aren't as good as they were back then. But somewhere along the line, I think John just, I don't know what happened to him, but maybe it was a gradual thing. But he became sort of like an emperor, a Caesar, one of the great sort of Caesars. And he said that All things in football come through him, and he became above everybody else. And he became arrogant, and he became a bit distrustful of friends as well. And he marginalised a lot of good people. And Brian Kerr makes that point as well in one of the pieces, that a lot of good people left the FAI in the last 14 years and weren't replaced by better ones. And then I kind of lost it with John a little bit, because I wrote something he didn't like, and he rang me up and he said, you know, you and I go back a long way. I said, we do, John, but I have to write what I think is the truth. And it may not portray you or the FAI in the proper light, but if I feel it's the truth, I'm going to put it to print. And he said, well, that may be the end of us in terms of... John's a very good source for stories, and as journalists can confirm for many years afterwards. And he just had to bite the bullet. And other guys, Paul Holland, who was digging away as hard as I was, and Paul Roan and Dion, who came around a little bit, I think, and did a very good interview with John after Euro 2012.
Yeah, 2012, yeah.
And Paul Lennon of the Star as well. And it wasn't easy for us, Joe. I can tell you, there were phone calls made to us. And one person rang me in the FAI and said, you know, numbers are being watched here. Who's ringing who? And just be careful type thing. It wasn't quite a warning, but you kind of felt you'd be careful
that
who you spoke to.
Yeah.
And people were advised not to talk. But somewhere along the line, John went from being a sort of working for the association to, I believe, not quite working for himself, but he saw himself as, you know, the Sun King.
Yeah.
And also he was totally impervious to criticism.
Well, he will dispute that, I'm sure, as is his right. And I'm sure we'll hear from him.
I asked what his legacy was. I asked Paul Cook what was John Delaney's legacy. Mm. And he kind of said, well, this is a dark day for the Irish football. And he sort of said, well, the figures, they speak for themselves. So basically he was saying the figures, 63 million, which we are in debt, and as we were in 2012, as Tommy said as well, we haven't moved on. Yeah. I say we as an Irish football, the figures speak for themselves, and that's his legacy, the figures.
Yes. Bernard, any pieces grab you? They're all of a similar vein.
Yeah, I think probably Eamon Sweeney's just around, you know, who's going to suffer from this. It's the average FAI employee, you know. The average wage is 30,000. The payoff was 462. That would have paid 15 of them. They're looking at pay cuts or redundancies. And then, you know, John Green finishes with a similar topic, kind of saying, you know, it's kind of like the banks and the Limbic Council of Ireland. It's the small man and woman on the streets who will suffer the most, and that's the worry. Obviously, this is a crazy situation. A huge amount of money in the future of the FAI as a governing body probably is up in the air. But it's how much the cutbacks are going to be at grassroots level to to fix this mess. You know, that's probably the something that's probably not clear. There's no clarity on that at the moment, and there's probably a lot of really good people in there who've done nothing wrong, who are suffering from the tarnished reputations they have by being associated with the FAI, and also the financial insecurities that they're going through at the moment.
Yeah. The one that struck me, and I spoke to some of the employees,
right,
and they said, and let's praise the Sunday Times for breaking the story back in March with the news of the 100,000 loan that Lenny gave the association, which the FAI tried to suppress, by the way, and the officers who are, some of whom are still there, didn't stop Lenny trying to suppress it. But I spoke to some people, and they said, as the Sunday Times were drip feeding, you know, revelations of Delaney's excesses, the one that caught them was the €3,000 a month rental allowance. And they're going, that's €36,000 a year in rental allowance, and he's on €365,000, irrespective of his expenses. And these are people here who are trying to make ends meet, to keep pay their mortgage, to keep a roof over their head. And that's what struck in their craw most of all. And they also took wage cuts a couple of years ago and pension cuts, and they're still waiting for full restoration of that. And that's what really annoyed them, that the 3,000 a month for put a roof over his head, when those people on the coalface were struggling to do the exact same. Just one other thing, and just...
Final point on this, yeah.
Okay, final point.
Sorry.
Joe, you're not...
I'm sorry, well, you make a quick final point.
Just the Sunday Times, their headline, like, the boys in green are deep in red. I like that one. Brian Kerr, a lot of good people are discarded. And Kerr has a quote in the Sunday World as well, which is quite damning, you know, and he fell out with Delaney, and... he was ostracised, appallingly, from Irish football. Yeah, that's been discussed, Brian, but not even getting tickets for matches after what he did for Irish football.
Own hand is the same.
And Des Casey, who was a former FA president and treasurer, was given a seat at the very top of the East Upper Stand. Des is 85 with mobility issues. And this was all allowed to happen under Lenny's watch. Kerr says they travelled first class. They wined and dined in fancy hotels while Rome burned under their arses. That's a good, strong quote.
Yeah.
And Kerr cares. Always remember that. He cares.
Yeah. I mean, when you see the full stadiums, when you see what close to 450,000 people involved in the sport around the country, the most popular sport in many ways, the one we watch, the one kids are obsessed with, it's amazing that the revenue never improved. It's amazing that they find themselves in this mess.
The bottom line was, and it's touched upon, and I won't go back at it, but they lost so much money in the Vantage Club that they find a way of funding their stadium bill in the Aviva. And every penny that FAI got, Delaney got, it went into that hole, so it couldn't go elsewhere. But obviously, a lot of money also went into looking after his own lifestyle. And that's, you know, that's part of the cab inquiry. But there is a chink of light, Joe, and while the FAI say they never put faith, they never do their budgets around the fact that the Irish team have to qualify for major tournaments, it does help. And if McCarthy can lead a way through the playoffs in March...
You make this point, don't you?
He has to win two away games. It will probably cut their debts by a third, almost immediately, because they get £9.5 million for qualifying for UEFA.
I'll quote you. You say, if McCarthy can somehow plot a way through, it would wipe off around 33% of the association's €62 million debt. So you talk about, well, there'd be no trouble getting team sponsors. That'd be about €10 million. On top of that, you'd get a minimum of €9.2 million for qualifying, while one win from three group games yields another million.
You might get another draw. You might even get out of the group.
That's a hell of a pre-match team talk, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Mick, you're not doing it for yourselves, lad. You're doing it for the grassroots. And it could happen. And I think actually that the Irish football team is not as bad as some people make it out to be. And I think if Connolly keeps progressing, and Tripartite made his debut yesterday, you know, I think that they have a chance of getting through those two matches. And if they do, I think Mick McCarthy will be made St. Michael of Abbottstown, because he will have got them out of a huge, huge financial hole.
Okay, very good. Very short break. Back in a second. More from Bernard Jackman and Philip Quinn.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now then, welcome back. So it's the paper review. We have Bernard Jackman in studio and Philip Quinn as well. We're trying to get through as much as we can. A bit tighter today than usual, given the kickoff times. We've already brought you the Connacht game, and we have Premier League action on the way. So, Bernard Jackman, a rough Thursday morning for Joe Schmidt, who would have woken up to headlines which quite literally said, Best and IRFU blame Schmidt. There are a couple of pieces today just picking up on the week that was, including we have Rory Keane in the Mail on Sunday saying IRFU and Nusafora need to take a look in the mirror. Joe Schmidt's taken plenty of blame for Ireland's World Cup failure, but his former employers are culpable too. We have Peter O'Reilly in the Sunday Times saying Schmidt must stop playing the victim is the headline in his piece. And then in the Sunday Independent, for instance, Brendan Fanny is saying, Rory Best revelation showed that senior players must make their voices heard during the Andy Farrell era. And then Neil Francis, Schmidt has taken too, sorry, changed the meaning of that significantly. Schmidt has too much credit in the bank to deserve this criticism. Neil Francis' piece is kind of a very interesting read. He draws a parallel, and he admits it's not a perfect one because things haven't ended so perfectly for Schmidt, but a parallel with Michael Jordan and Chicago, and how when he joined Chicago, it's because they were rotten and they were terrible. That's how the draft works. Progress slow. In 91, the Bulls won their first ever championship. They followed it up with wins in 92 and 93, all down to Jordan. The 94 season, he goes off and plays baseball, infamously, and then he comes back and they win three in a row, 96 to 98. His feats in 98 defied logic and reality as he produced match-winning performances and seminal plays without parallel in the modern era of sport. And then, absolutely nothing. At the end of 2019, Michael Jordan's still a hero in Chicago. And then he says, well, speaking of Chicago, first time in 100 years Ireland beat New Zealand, 40 points to 29. Nobody puts 40 points in the All Blacks. It was all down to Schmidt's keen rugby intellect. A bit like the Bulls, there was nothing much before, and I wager there will be nothing again for a long time. Talks about the deeply disappointing World Cup, but then says he's getting too much criticism now, says that the media certainly are taking almost a certain joy in criticising Schmidt after a tense relationship for a long time. And he says, it is conceivable Ireland might not win anything for a long time, and maybe all of us should reflect on an era of success and sporting prosperity which is without parallel in this country. Finishes with his last line, let's see how we get on without him. That last line I'm inclined to agree with, I must say. Obviously, he hasn't been perfect this year, but a rotten week for a coach, even just on a personal level, I would think, when your captain comes out and says this.
I felt very sorry for him, and I think... So Neil, you know, Neil is saying that some of the journalists are potentially getting pleasure from seeing him squirm, and maybe it's a bit of payback for the relationship. The relationship obviously wasn't
perfect
over the last couple of years.
And Schmidt would have played his part in that.
Yeah, 100%. And that's the decision he made, you know, and coaches and managers will make decisions and follow through on them. And results will often dictate whether it's seen as being correct or not. But Frano probably wasn't. Even though he's highly involved in rugby, he wasn't at press conferences and didn't need Joe day to day. So he's a little bit away from it, which is probably nice, a nice different opinion on it. And I would agree with him. I think that Joe's legacy is incredibly favourable, and I'm not taking any pleasure in seeing him suffer. It looks like he's suffering because, you know, he's written the book. He hasn't thrown anyone under the bus, and people can say that he hasn't given the minute detail about why it went wrong, and there's maybe a chance he doesn't understand yet why it went wrong. I mean, there's so many different factors that went into a team slipping, and it's hard to quantify them all, and it's hard to, I suppose, give details on them without maybe blaming others. And so I think I admire Joe's dignity in this. I think it would be very hard for him on Thursday evening to have to go out and front in front of an audience and, you know, having found out what Rory said, and I think he didn't get involved in a tit for tat. You know, I know Peter Riley says he must stop playing the victim. I don't know how much of a victim he's really playing. I mean, he's not unscathed in this. I mean, I think potentially what happened is Joe wanted to be successful at a World Cup more than anything he's ever wanted in his life, and potentially that affected, you know, some of the other stuff. But it wasn't a case of didn't put the work in, didn't try and find the best methods. He made decisions, and there's a lot of people involved in decision making in a high performance sport. And, you know, the rest of his coaching staff is head of S&C, he's head of medical, you know, David Nusafour is head of performance, plus the leadership group. And I know that this is something that, you know, that Rory obviously felt that they'd lost maybe control of the week, and particularly the end of the week. But again, you know, you can see from Joe's point of view when he sees the team maybe underperform and they're coming to a crunch game against New Zealand where he knows they're going to have to pull out, you know, an unbelievable performance, a performance like, the, you know, the quality of which was 12 months before, that he wants to maybe cover all the options and just make sure that everybody is 100% on script.
That was the sense I got from him on Thursday night. There was an interview I did with him in front of a audience down in University Concert Hall in Limerick, and his sense was the players came to him after the England game at Twickenham in the summer, which was a disaster, and they said, we need you to step back a bit. And I spoke to another player who told me that in his time under Schmidt, Schmidt on occasion would say to that player towards the end of a week, we're going to let Owen Redden take the captain's run today. I won't even be there. It's over to you. So this was a thing he would definitely do. I know we think he's hands-on at all times, but he would even just hand over a training session to the players at times. But Schmidt said on Thursday, or gave the impression on Thursday, that he did step back after meeting with the players, the leadership group after the England game, and he almost regrets stepping back too much. And maybe the week in the New Zealand game felt, I need to get on top of things a little bit more here. But again, he was certainly saying that he thinks Rory Best was misconstrued, that Rory Best had been on to him. Now, Brendan Fanning says of Wednesday, Rory Best was asked just four questions and yet he spoke for 18 minutes. According to Schmidt, the hooker texted the next day claiming that inadvertently he may have said things in the wrong manner. Brendan Fanning says to that, right. And I think it's incredibly fair of Joe Schmidt to take that explanation from Rory Best. I think he doesn't want to get into a tit for tat, so he's given him the benefit of the doubt. Rory Best, 37 years old, has done lots of media. He spoke for 18 minutes. I tried to say several times to Schmidt on Thursday, Joe, there's about 500 words of quotes here. This isn't two lines which have been blown up and twisted. These are damning quotes. He has said damning things here, and even then there was a reluctance to accept that. And the same with the IRFU and their review. And I asked a journalist, very fair journalist, who was at the IRFU briefing, and I said, it reads to me like Nusafora is saying, you know, the game plan needed to evolve. Underestimation of Japan, that reads to me as really damning a Schmidt, even though they never mentioned my name. And the journalist said, my entire sense across the 28 minutes was they were driving the bus over Joe and reversing back once or twice as well.
Yeah, but the only person not staying on is really Joe, effectively.
So isn't that convenient?
Yeah, so that's why I think it's harsh. I genuinely think that's harsh. And it's not like we need to know, the public don't need to know every detail about what went wrong, but it's very easy to stand back now and say, because it hasn't been successful, is, yeah, we underestimated Japan, the game plan didn't evolve. But the game plan wasn't that different in Japan at the World Cup than it was in the Six Nations. It wasn't mighty different. So, what are people doing in around that? You know, if you sense that and you early, why aren't you having that conversation? Because in fairness to Joe, as most head coaches are, like control. But at the end of the day, I mean, he's a really good communicator. And if you have that conversation with him and he really feels that he's right, he'll be able to explain that to you in a very clear and concise way. So, and then you're involved, then you're part of the decision-making process. So I do feel for Joe this week. I don't think the World Cup, he played a part in the World Cup failure as any coach and player did.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For sure. But I think it was the best intentions. He doubled down maybe. And I would say, you know, part of the issue is, you know, Rory said, oh, we should, like, David Kilcoyne should have played, maybe should have played one of the games.
Against Japan.
Yeah, like maybe Rory shouldn't have played, you know, in all the
Rory
games.
Rory said that about himself.
Yeah.
Rory said, at my age, to go 6-day turnaround to play against Japan, maybe that would have been a lot for me. And you know, maybe I thought that was a lot for me. And as if you can't say to Joe Schmidt, I'm feeling the pace here, 6-day turnaround, maybe
exactly.
We swap me in, swap me out.
Yeah, so I think the overall, it's a collective failure rather than an individual failure, and it's not Rory Best's fault either. It's a collective failure, and I think that's the most important thing. And I think for us, the easiest thing to do is to blame Joe Schmidt. He's gone. It's all gonna be fine. You know, the next World Cup. That's not the answer.
The IRFU review comes pretty close to that, I feel.
Maybe it does, but that's. Which I don't think that's very fair.
No, that's my point.
Yeah,
I agree with you.
And I think Frano. Fairness to Frano, he's coming at it from maybe a little bit more detached, and he's seen all the good things that Joe has done, and whoever gets Joe Schmidt next are going to be incredibly lucky, whether they're a country or a club. Mm. But there's a lot of people didn't get their part of the job right, players and anyone involved in preparation, and we just need to accept that now and move on. And internally, when they go back in, the biggest one, the most important review is when Andy Farrell has his squad in over the next couple of weeks. It's the lessons that are and the learnings that are agreed upon there that are important. You know what I mean? And if it is a leadership, if the leadership group didn't feel they had the authority to speak to Joe, you know, maybe something that's down to the lack of form of the leadership group. You know, in terms of the maybe not feeling that they're guaranteed their own position on merit, and you know, things can change very quickly in a high performance in any elite sport, in any sport. And it just seems it was the perfect storm where the senior players maybe didn't feel that they were on form. There was injury, maybe didn't feel that they merited a position on the field. There was some of the guys outside were in better form, And then that makes it harder to really, I suppose, be forceful with the coaching staff. But Joe Schmidt also isn't, like, he has a defence coach, a scrum coach, a backs coach, a skills coach.
Yeah.
You know, and I know he was involved in everything, but there's a huge amount of intelligence and quality in the backroom staff as well. So I just think it's such an easy thing to do is to blame the fella who's not going to be there anymore, and we all move on. But I don't think that's the best practice in terms of how a review should look.
I'm not buying, by the way, I'll bring you in now, Philip, and get your thoughts on all this. I'm not buying this tension stuff either.
No.
That's such nonsense.
But like, this Irish team...
Tension doesn't explain a really, really below par Six Nations.
No.
And tension doesn't explain the year before how they win. Like, the pressure around that New Zealand game in the November was serious. And going to Twickenham to win a Grand Slam was serious. So, like, the tension thing...
And the reason that Joe Schmidt and players spoke about him so highly, and players went back to their own provinces demanding that the coaches there replicate and create the same type of atmosphere he does, is because they wanted this detail and pressure and accountability. So you can't be saying that, you know, it's what's making us the best team in the world in 2018, and then when it continues, say, oh no, we know what we need to do. You know, you can leave us alone here. And in fairness, even if you did give them, like, the reality was, what does a coach do when he sees the team not performing to the levels that they had before in 2018, and standards started dropping, lose to Wales and have a poor Six Nations, you know, have a poor game against England, you know, a poor game against Japan? Does he just sit back and go, look, it's going to work out, cross my fingers? You know, a coach's job is to react to the situation he sees at training and in games, and try and influence.
Well, if you said what was one of the most celebrated aspects of Schmidt's reign, people would say the detail.
100%.
And now it's exactly. the stick to beat him with. It's madness.
Madness, yeah.
And I'm not saying he's blameless, of course he isn't, but like the simplification here this week is just a hatchet.
Yeah, but Joe as well, I mean, you have to understand in team environments across all sports, if the results start to diminish,
yeah,
people will pick up on little triggers. So someone influential in the team who's not getting picked, who says, oh, the meetings are too long, suddenly that becomes something to hang your hat on, you know? And it's so easy now for anyone involved. If the 50 people who gave feedback to Noosa Fora, you know, and they all said, oh, the meetings were too long, there was too much tension, too much detail, you know, that doesn't accept any responsibility on their part.
Mm.
And they walk away and they throw the gear bag in the storage unit and go, you know, I wasn't a part of that. It wasn't my fault.
In fairness to Rory Best, which I know hasn't been the theme of this conversation, he did cite the players having a certain complacency in Portugal. But again, I find that staggering. And if he's part of the leadership group, that is very much on them. And I would presume that's why he was saying it. So it wasn't just Joe Schmidt. So we did make that point. Who'd be a coach, eh?
Yeah. No, but listen, it just shows you how fickle it is. I mean, he is, I would say, one of the best coaches
still
in the world. Still, oh no, for sure. But now he has to listen to a lot of nonsense, I think, and people trying to discredit him, which isn't fair, but that's what you sign up to.
I don't discount Peter O'Reilly's view, though, that it's also good, because it was my sense a little bit, your default can't be to be defensive when people are giving you feedback. He may have to, in the cold light of day, listen to something or reflect on something and see, and I'm sure he'll do that. Philip Quinn.
Just a couple of observations, Joe, and two things. If Smith wasn't going, if he was still the head coach of the Irish rugby team, would these comments have been made?
By the IRFU?
Yeah, well, they've done it. They do review any year, anyway.
Yeah.
But would players have felt the way that they were? That maybe they felt free to maybe be a bit more critical because he's no longer there.
Yeah.
If he was still there, would they have been critical? That's one observation. Another observation: slight echoes, Best comments, slight echoes, only slight, of Keenan McCarthy and Saipan in 2002, of maybe a little bit of a schism. The difference being that Best didn't say anything till Smith was off stage, whereas Keane was quite happy to let anybody know that he didn't like McCarthy and the way things were going, and they were still there. While he was playing under McCarthy, so just the thing that struck me. If Best didn't feel comfortable, he should have spoken up earlier.
Yeah, because he was in a position to do so as the
absolutely,
captain of the team.
Yeah. And one other observation, and again, I'm a rugby sort of, I'm on the outside looking in, but you touched about it there. 2018 was an extraordinary year for Irish rugby. We won the Grand Slam, which we don't do too often. I don't think we ever won it away in England. To go to England to win it. We beat the All Blacks. We beat the All Blacks.
Yes, certainly. Yeah.
So I mean, I think that those results were exceptional, and we got to number one in the world rankings. So like, I think give the guy a lot of praise. But when I saw the draw of the World Cup and I saw we were in against New Zealand and South Africa from day one, I'm thinking it doesn't matter how good Ireland are, those two teams, They kind of
tough.
Build everything around World Cups,
sure.
And they've got much deeper
Japan defeat is what's damning
us. Yeah, but even if we lost Japan, Joe, we still would have played. We would have played South Africa.
I know, but it just feed into the sense that, well, actually, we were never going to beat whoever was in that quarterfinal because the team wasn't going well. Japan makes it a far darker story, unfortunately, for him. If they'd beaten Japan well and then lost New Zealand in exactly the same way, it would have been a more palatable World Cup, I think.
So, in other words, you're losing a quarter-final, but there's one way of losing and another way of losing.
Probably,
you're still losing a quarter-final.
Yes.
You still haven't been to a World Cup semi-final.
Yeah. But it's more palatable.
Is it?
I think so. Do you not think so? When you lose to Japan, there's a sense that this thing's gone way off track.
Sure.
Defeat is a defeat.
Now, the reality is Japan actually are an okay team. You know what I mean? So, it's not as bad as it would have been
four
years
ago. They beat South Africa in the last World Cup, John?
Yeah, they did.
Burnley?
Yeah, but it's just the whole optics of it. And we didn't really hit form.
No,
to the level.
The whole year.
So that was the problem.
So what next? What happens now for us? Well, what would be a good 2020? You know, because if we're not putting much store on, will winning the Six Nations be good again, or beating in the next autumn series, and we beat the All Blacks and we're back up again?
That'd be phenomenal.
Or is it all about doing well every 4 years? What do people want from Irish rugby?
I know, it's a fair point. I did ask Schmidt. I said, do you subscribe to the notion it's all about what you do in the World Cup, and ultimately you're a failure because two quarterfinals?
What did he say today?
Or do you look at the tenure of your work? The wins against New Zealand, the win in South Africa, the win in Australia, the three Six Nations, the Grand Slams. And he said, I still feel very sore about the World Cup, so I can't really feel like a massive success. But he said, over time, I am going to focus on the fact that we were in the top four the whole time I was in charge, and we did get consistent. And so I think he will veer more towards taking a nuanced, fairer view of it. But I think right now he's still in the smog. Yeah. The smog of it all.
Hopefully he does, because he deserves to take
his body of work is exceptional.
Sure, yeah. And listen, if he wasn't good, like he, you know, most presidents in France, CEOs of governing bodies, if they need a coach, he'd be on the top two or three on the list worldwide.
So he hasn't been damaged.
No, he won't be. No, because Ireland, I mean, what he's done with Ireland, aren't a South African, New Zealand, or Australia on that level. Like, to get to world number one, is an outlier. Mm. You know, and he's been part of that.
So we still have loads to get to. There's Owen O'Gara in the Sunday Times, Michael Darren McCauley. Johnny Evans does a very interesting interview in the Sunday Times as well. There's Joshua Ruiz. I do, though, because I just think it's important while we're still on air, want to reference Paul Kimmage's piece in the Sunday Independent, which people might want to read, be of interest to you. Talking about various things here. So it starts with, well, Anthony Joshua obviously has been accused of taking part in sports washing, as it's now called. It's in the dictionary as of last year, that word, over in Saudi Arabia, and wonders about Dan Roan's role. You know, Dan Roan of the BBC was over in Saudi Arabia quizzing Joshua about it. Joshua almost turned to Roan and said, well, why are you covering the event? Because you want to get eyeballs on the BBC, so there are hypocrites out there. I wouldn't agree with that point, I have to say. The significance of the event, he's so clearly in the public interest, and Dan Roan is over asking questions about various aspects of it. That is fair enough. And it's not like he's taking money from Saudi Arabia, nor is he promoting the country. If anything, he's over there doing the opposite. And so Paul Kimmage rightly makes the point that journalists are often very quick to ask these questions of sports people, and that he says journalists are often found wanting themselves. And he goes on to talk about the situation with News Talk and the Irish Times, the dispute which is ongoing. I'm sure you remember Fintan O'Toole wrote a stinging piece on News Talk. There were aspects of it which the company found objectionable. They looked for an apology. No apology was forthcoming. That dispute and that standoff certainly continues. He also references the currency, which he says is deemed a competitor platform. And he calls that an unfortunate coincidence given the staff at the currency. I am 100% informed that the currency is not banned from News Talk, and it is deemed a competitor platform, like many other platforms are. And every media organization has competitor platforms. So that situation continues. And Paul talked to a couple of journalists who appeared on Communicore stations, and a lot of them said, well, he says the theme that emerged was, I care about my family and keeping a roof over their heads. That's my only priority, doing the best work I can to keep the show on the road. And Paul says, and that's fine, and I get that, but can we honestly criticize boxers or golfers or tennis players for doing the same? Which is a very interesting question, actually, and one I think about a lot in this job. So there's no blanket answer is the short answer, and then the longer answer is tricky. For instance, if you take journalists, how far do you go with that presumption that they need to have a certain moral standing to critique. So how perfect does a journalist have to be to criticise anyone? Because we are, trust me, some of the most deeply flawed people on the planet, make mistakes. So how good a person do you have to be to get on your high horse? And who judges that? And also, what areas of your life do you have to be perfect in or good in? For instance, Eamon Dunphy, very memorably on RTE, said to Bill O'Herlihy, of a journalist who had criticised Roy Keane, that's the fella who left his wife and ran off with a young one. Does that preclude him from commenting on Roy Keane? I don't know, is an interesting point. And then that's the journalist side of things, and then there are the sports people. So if you have Rory McIlroy hanging out with Trump, if you have someone like Joshua taking the 60 million in Saudi Arabia, I think that is very different to a struggling golfer or a struggling boxer whose livelihood is on the line and they choose to go to Saudi Arabia. I've no problem with that latter point. Rory hanging out with Trump, Joshua taking the 60 million. I think that's a grayer area. So we are full of compromises and contradictions.
We
but it's an interesting point. That's on page 7 of the Sunday Independent. I am being roared at to go to a break.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is. One point I will make is the World Cup finals are in Qatar in 2022.
Will you go?
Well, if Ireland qualify, you know, would I go? I'd love to go. I'd like to report on Ireland, a major international tournament. Am I aware that Qatar almost certainly bribed the votes for that World Cup? Yes. Am I aware that they have a terrible record of human rights? Yes. Mm. Women in particular don't have any quality of life there. So if I want to be moral about it, I say I'm not going. But yet the sports journalist and I feel the sports pages. I'm not on the news pages. I don't have a radio program that talks about morality. So, but I can understand why people would have an issue with that. But yeah, I'd love to be there. Whether I'm going to be there or not, I'm not quite sure. Mm. It is a tricky one. You got to juggle with your conscience a little bit, and you got to remember then who's paying you. Mm. Like, you know, you have to do your job. Mm. But it depends on how you interpret your job, and Paul interprets it there, and he raises a few valid points.
Yeah.
I mean, Saudi Arabia is an interesting one, Joe, because they are paying huge money to make a big events. Mm. Dustin Johnson played there in the European Tour last year. Mm. He doesn't cross the road for less than $1 million, mm. and he actually went all the way to Saudi Arabia in that same tournament where Sergio Garcia gave out, because apparently he wasn't on the same whack as all the other ones were on. But the golfing journalists were all there writing about it, writing about the tournament, the fact that they had great big names there.
Yeah.
But why were they there? Because they're getting paid.
It's true. We've got to take a short break. We do want to touch, before we get over to Nathan, on the O'Gara interview, Johnny Evans, and a quick word on Joshua Ruiz, the fight as well. Back in a second.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Okay, welcome back. So, unfortunately, we have 9 minutes, which is not enough time to get through everything. But we should mention to you, Owen O'Gara opens up, is the headline with Michael Foley. Really good piece, talking about his travails with Dublin over the years and very nice memories of Anton O'Toole. That is on page 9 of the Sunday Times and definitely worth a read on O'Gara today. Also in the Sunday Times, and I'm going to come to your piece in a moment, Philip, with Johnny Evans on page 5. The thing about, do you know what made me turn to, Bernard, I know you like this. In Roy Keane's second book, Johnny Evans gets a brief mention, and it's when he's a young kid at Carrington and there's some dispute with a senior player in the canteen.
Yeah.
And Keane says that the young Evans knocked the other fella out. And so I thought, I respect this kid. I like this kid. He's got a bit about him. So here we are, how many years later, aged 32, and he's at Leicester City. And he's done a really good interview with Jonathan Northcroft. Sometimes these Premier League interviews are not that interesting. Goes into detail about the birth of his child the week before, which happened right outside the A&E, where there was some guy having a smoke, telling them, you can't park here. And his wife was saying, the baby's coming out. The head was completely out. One push. She only had to push once. The baby cried as soon as he came out. And then there was a midwife who'd... was a friend and had tailed him in the car, and she was there and she put him in Helen's chest. And all the time the guy kept saying, you can't park here, mate. So that was the birth of Evans's child the week before. The way Leicester signed him is very interesting.
Yeah, I think that was the most interesting. Obviously, Brendan Rodgers has gone into Leicester and he's been very successful. But, and you know, probably from the outside, when they won the title in 2015-16, we didn't really see it coming.
Yeah.
But when you listen to him and the structures that are in place. So when he agreed to sign from June 2018, Leicester's director of football, John Rudkin, he travelled to Aldrey Edge to make a memo pitch to the office of Evans' agent, and basically had a dossier of every game he played in the last three or four seasons. They had them all graded. And what Evans liked was, you know, they weren't all A's and B's. There was a C- in there. Mm. And he actually remembered
he looked where the negative one was and was Watford away, and he agreed he had a bad day that day, and he liked the fact that they were, I suppose, they were classifying his performances in a similar manner to himself and not sugarcoating it.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, I think you've seen guys leave Man United and never really kind of progress to the same level. But he, at 32, or 31 he would have been then, you know, he wanted this club where it was very transparent, it was accountable. Mm. And he went there and he just speaks about kind of what he's learning from an S&C point of view. He's putting on a bit of size, he's still developing, the quality of the younger players they have. And also a little anecdote as well about, you know, his time with United, and he didn't have an agent. And he was haggling a little bit with Ferguson over his contract, which led to Ferguson, you know, pretty much highlighting when he made a mistake in a game against Milan and giving him the hairdryer treatment. And he was asked, what do you learn from that? He said, get an agent. So, it's a really good article. But you can see, you know, Brendan Rodgers is obviously bringing some good detail to it, but there's some pretty sound philosophies, you know, underpinning that success.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, amazing, not amazing given the money in the game, but that Leicester tracked this guy for 3 years and had a school mark beside every single performance across 3 years. Like, they may well never have signed him. It's a huge investment of time, which may come to nothing. By the way, half time in that match when he's haggling with his contract, effing wake up, says Ferguson. Half time, he came for me again. Had I not learned to kick a ball off the ground when I was at school, Ferguson wanted to know. Going through my head was, I went to a rugby school, but I didn't say it out loud. I can imagine not. That's on page 5, that's good. And then Jim Carney, I mean, the Sunday game obviously celebrated its tenure recently.
Yeah. We all know the music. Ba, 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 ba. But the very first
presenter
was the great Jim Carney. And
Uncle of Kieran Murphy.
Yeah, one of the nicest guys you'll meet in broadcasting and in journalism, and lovely piece by Dermot Crowe in the Sunday Indo, and Jim is almost 70, I think it says here, and because it's 40 years of Sunday game, he was the first guy, so time to sort of bit down memory lane with Jim Carney, and on a personal note, I go back a long way with Jim, because it says here that in 1975, RTE came up with a sports show for kids, and he was given the task of presenting it. And I remember being one of those kids on that show and getting to meet the great Jim Carney. And he made me feel very much at ease, and he was like a godlike. And he was a lovely fella. And he's been a lovely fella. And still a very amiable and approachable guy. And he tells a few little stories about the Sunday game and dressing room interviews and whatever. But he tells a little yarn as well about the World Cup in 78, which I forgot. RTE did a great job in the 78 World Cup finals in Argentina. They had a whole platoon out there, including Billy George, the examiner, and it was Jim McGee and Tim O'Connor and Mikey Horgan were the men behind it calling the shots. And Jim was there, and he was talking about himself and Jim McGee were crossing on a marathon rail trip across the Pampas, and they couldn't fly because of fog. And they passed each other time with a quiz on GA knowledge, you know. And as Jim says, I was taking on the memory man. He says,
"This, by the way, that would be my worst nightmare."
Taking on Jimmy, you know,
on that train. With that
Jimmy,
going on.
You know, go on, train me. Go on, the memory man. I tell you, well, where's that hotel, Jimmy? And they nearly came to blows over what was the Tipperary full forward line in the 1964 All Ireland final. They were arguing over which McLaughlin brother was in the team, you know. And and then they got to the ground, and then they, you know, and there was they walked in with the Argentinian lads were getting off the bus, and Menotti and Passarella. And there they were right beside them, much different in those days than it is now. But Jim, just one little thing about Jim, and he did the Sunday game, and then he had a car crash, and he came back with a tough car crash, and you still hear him on RT on Sunday during the championship season.
Yeah.
But he one of the little stories I'm going to tell you about him. Oh yeah, the Tuam background. Tuam, he began in Tuam. We were talking about your Tullow connection and whatever, and the Sporting people came out of there, but he came from Tuam, and the Tuam Herald is where he started, and that's where Michael Lester came through, learned, he graduated from there, and Martin Breheny, the recently retired GAA correspondent of the Irish Independent. So Tuam has given us some great GAA figures in terms of journalism and broadcasting, and Jim Carney was the first one. Happy 70th, Jim.
Gentlemen, thanks so much for that. I know it was a little bit more rushed than usual, but I think we got through our fair share. Bernard Jackman and Philip Quinn, who you'll be reading across the week in the mail. Thanks, fellas. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.